Well, welcome. Thank you all very much for coming. This is going to be very informal. And in fact, if you would like to sort of, I don't know, if you want to open up the tables and chairs a little bit,
sure.
Not quite as classroom-like, or more classroom-like, or whatever you want to do. I'm going to scoot this out just a little bit so there's some room.
We reorient every half hour.
Yeah,
that's
right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
On the half hour, everyone will rotate a 90-degree angle. Just kidding, kidding.
So by the end, we're going to be facing the back wall.
Yes, exactly. Very good. Well, I'm Elizabeth Rappasarda. I work for Dennis Hall in the Office of Research and Graduate Education, as it is known broadly, and I am the de facto moderator of this panel today. I want to welcome everyone for coming. Again, the idea is, yes, we're doing a PowerPoint, yes, they're handouts, but it's really much more informational. If you've got questions, please feel free to ask. This is conceived as the first part of a two-part program on grantsmanship for junior tenure track faculty. It's not meant to be a primer. It's not meant to be a nuts and bolts. These are the explicit steps to walk you through submitting a proposal in COEUS. Sorry, John. It's really more to give you a sense of how grants management is handled at Vanderbilt in this session. And then next week, we'll have some faculty here to talk about sort of hints on getting grants, tips and tricks for dealing with getting grants, federal agencies, corporate or foundation funders, that sort of thing. So this is really the administrative overview, if you will. And the folks here represent, in some respects, the key offices that you need to deal with at Vanderbilt when you're involved in grants management. So item one, rotate every half hour, kidding. Item two, please feel free to ask questions. If there's anything you'd like to ask or anything that doesn't get covered, we've tried to provide you have all the slides, their websites listed, their phone numbers listed, so that hopefully anything here, you'll be able to go back and if you have follow-up questions, check with anyone. Before we get started, because it is a small group and because I think it would be helpful to us, could we do the proverbial go around the room, more for us to understand what disciplines you're from, because clearly grantsmanship is very different sometimes depending on the discipline you're in. So, and then I'll introduce the panelists and off we'll go. So would you like to start?
Yeah, sure. My name is Roberto Garcia and I'm from English.
Okay.
I'm Kath Baker. I'm assistant director here at the Center for Teaching.
So Patricia Armstrong, Center for Teaching in French.
Carol Atkinson, Political Science.
Claudia Ray, Economics.
Bob Webster, Mechanical Engineering.
Okay.
Stephen Benning, Psychology.
I'm Dahlia Porter, I'm also from English.
I'm Vanessa Beasley from Communication Studies and Arts and Science Program for Career Development.
Derek Brough here at the Center for Teaching and also in math. And I wanted to say just one word. We are audio recording this session mainly to get some pearls of wisdom from these folks. So we won't use anything that you say. We'll edit all that out. So,
unless it's really good.
And then I'll get your permission.
Yeah. So I'm just going to, as I said, I'm Elizabeth Rappasarda in Research Administration. I'll be roughly moderating. Each of the people here represents an office that has responsibilities in the process of applying for and getting grants. Shelley Richards, the lovely Shelley Richards, is currently a grants administrator for several faculty in the Department of Chemistry, but she has been a departmental administrator and so has that school department perspective that we thought would be really helpful. John Childress is the director of the Division of Sponsored Research, and we'll talk a little bit more. John will talk a little bit more about what that means and what his office does. Michelle Vazin, the lovely Michelle Vazin, is in the Office of Contract and Grant Accounting. And Dennis Hall, who is Dean of the Graduate School and Associate Provost for Research, will give sort of the institutional perspective and a bit of a wrap-up. So I'm going to take just a minute. As you see, we're going to walk you through the process just a little bit. and then hopefully have some time for some Q&A. One thing that when Allison, Derek, and Vanessa and I were talking about this, we thought might be helpful is talk a little bit about the way Vanderbilt is organized. Many of you come from very different types of institutions. I've worked at land-grant institutions. I've worked at other privates. Everybody's organized very differently. And we thought it might be helpful if you had a little bit of a sense of the way Vanderbilt is organized. We have a chancellor who's like a president who essentially is the CEO. One of the misconceptions I hear a lot is, well, there's the university and there's the medical center. But the reality is Vanderbilt is a single corporation. It has only one board that has fiduciary responsibilities. So when you have a funder that says we will only take one proposal from Vanderbilt, that means all of Vanderbilt. That means whether you're in a college or the medical center or a center, there's only one entity that the agency recognizes as receiving the funds, and that sometimes creates confusion. We have 8 vice chancellors, and John has a slide a little bit later that has a better layout of the org chart, but just to let you know, we do have the provost, Richard McCarty, who handles the non-medical academic side of things. He's also the vice chancellor for academic affairs. And then the medical center has a vice chancellor for health affairs, Harry Jacobson, that has both research and clinical enterprises involved. And then the remaining vice chancellors provide services, if you will. This is my shorthand. They would all probably be furious if they heard me say this. But in a sense, provide services and institutional support to those two main academic pieces of campus. So that just gives you a real quick overview. And there are, the reason I presume you guys are here is to talk about research funding. There are clearly internal funding mechanisms available at Vanderbilt. Dennis is going to talk a little bit at the end about how some of the finances are handled. Next week we'll talk in more detail about the internal funding opportunities that are managed through Dennis's office, the Discovery Grants, the Research Scholar Grants, and then obviously there are external funding opportunities. The bulk of the external funding at Vanderbilt comes from federal funders. To a lesser extent, obviously, we have corporate foundation and association funding, but the majority of them are federal agencies. So today's session is what I jokingly call the Ghostbuster discussion. You know, who do you call? And the panelists are going to address the different perspectives. If you're a faculty member, the answer about who you call is it depends on what you need and when you need it and what you're trying to accomplish. So our hope is that these people will be able to give you a perspective about what the role of a department and a dean might be, what the role of sponsored research and Dennis's office might be, and then the contract and grant accounting folks, and why you actually need to make every one of these people your best friend if you want to get funding, because they all have a very important role to play and can be really helpful if you take advantage of it. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Shelley. And I'll manage the little doohickey for you if you want.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
My name is Shelley Richards, and I currently work in the Department of Chemistry. I work for 3 faculty members and handle all aspects of their grants administration and grants management. I've been working in some capacity in research administration for nearly 15 years. I spent my first 5 years at Vanderbilt in the math department and did grants administration for mathematicians. The next 5 years were spent in the Office of Technology Transfer, which is Vanderbilt's patent office that does all of the intellectual property management. And I've spent the last 5 years in the chemistry department, so I have a variety of experience. When I first started in grants administration, everything was done on paper and sent through the mail. So in the last 15 years, there have been a lot of changes in grants administration, both here at Vanderbilt and with the various foundations and agencies. Most places today, we have an electronic mechanism for submitting grants. And that changes. So the things that you hear and the things that you do today will be different 5 years from now. It's a very dynamic area, I think. And the departmental role is what I'm going to talk just a few minutes about. The department is sort of ground zero for grants administration. Grants are initiated in the department by the PI and eventually closed out in the department. And everything that occurs in between has something to do with the departmental administrators that you'll work with. Grants are initiated, assembled, and submitted by people that you'll work with, the administrators in your area. As grant awards are made and you get letters, you know, yes, you have money, you go then to your administrator in your department and they take care of setting up the center number where the money will be put for you to spend and do your research. That money over the life of that grant is tracked and reconciled in the department by the administrator. If you have a three-year grant, a lot of times you'll get monthly reports from your administrator about how much money has been spent, how much money is left to spend, if there's any erroneous charges to the grant or things like that. A lot of times your grant administrator can help you work those things out. Progress reports that are due to agencies are also something that the departmental administrator can assist you with. And grant closeout. So at the end of the grant period, when it's time to send the final report to the agency, a lot of times the administrator will help you with the paperwork that needs to be done and submitted to the agency for the final report. One of the faculty members that I talked to about this presentation today mentioned that one of the things that was really helpful for him was to have one-on-one meetings with his administrator on a monthly basis, or even if you only touch base quarterly. If you're not getting monthly reports, if you have a grant and you're not getting monthly reports about how much money is there, or what the charges are, whether or not the personnel that are being charged to the grant are appropriate, it's really important just to communicate with them, maybe set up quarterly meetings, depending on what your availability is, but staying on top of that throughout the life of the grant is really important. You don't want to find yourself in a situation where you get to the end of the grant period and the grant is overspent and you've got a $20,000 deficit and you've got to figure out a way how to handle that. So it's really good to stay on top of that. The department is also a liaison for the faculty member to a number of departments at Vanderbilt. I've got a list of them here. The dean's office, so a lot of times the departmental administrator will talk with the dean's office. Sometimes the PI and the administrator, but a lot of times in my situation, I know I've talked to the dean about, you know, various grants issues. The Division of Sponsored Research and Contracts and Grants Accounting all have people within their departments that have certain agencies that they work with or certain issues that they handle. A lot of times the departmental administrator will know who those people are. So if you have an issue with a grant in its particular agency, say the Department of Defense, a lot of times the administrator will know who the appropriate person is to call so that you don't have to spend your time, you know, wading through names or calling five different people to find out. And that information may be listed on your website, I'm not sure. But other departments, so if you're collaborating with someone in another department, a lot of times the administrator can handle calling the administrator in the other department so that you don't have to do the legwork there. Sometimes the Office of Technology Transfer, sometimes companies, foundations, agencies, and other institutions. Sometimes my PIs will be collaborating with someone at another institution, and I might be emailing back and forth that person's administrator and exchanging information so that the people that I work with can focus on the important components of their research, so that the paperwork and all of that that needs to be submitted is really the component that I handle so that they can focus on their science, and in your case, so that you can focus on whatever it is that you need to be focusing on, rather than completing the paperwork and things of that nature. Some things that you can do to help your administrator is make them aware of upcoming deadlines. So if you know about a deadline in advance, as soon as you can let them know, it's good to, you never know what can happen. And so if you wait until the last minute and something is wrong and something happens with the electronic submission process, you might not get another chance to submit that. And so if you can get information to the administrator far enough in advance so that if there are issues with submitting, then you have time to reconcile whatever those issues are. That way you don't lose that opportunity. There have been some situations where that's happened from time to time, so it's always good to plan ahead if you can. I know that's not always the reality. I've had many people over the years that had to have every second up until the last minute. Sometimes you're waiting on information from someone else, another institution or another department, and you just can't get everything in. But it's always good if you can to at least say, you know, this deadline is, you know, 90 days out, but I want to let you know that I am planning on this. And particularly if it's a complicated grant, or if the submission process is going to be really complex, it's good to know in advance. If you're talking to companies about contracts, that's another area where it's very important to talk to your administrator. A lot of times people, faculty will engage in conversations and talk to companies about doing or conducting research or collaborating with research, and sometimes if the information isn't filtered over fast enough, then we get in a situation where they want to begin the research, but there's not a fully executed contract in place, and or we don't have the money, and sometimes we can get into some ruts there. So if you think that you're interested in collaborating with someone at a company or entering into a contract situation, it's good to talk to your administrator. I know there's been many times where I've called the Department of Sponsored Research here and gotten our boilerplate agreement that we have and send it to the company, and they review the language, and that can get things going more quickly. If you are meeting with your departmental administrator regarding your grant, a lot of times if you notice if there's any kind of erroneous charges, or sometimes it's good just to make sure that the personnel that are listed on the grant are actually working on the grant. We've had situations where people might be paid and maybe they're not working on the grant, or maybe they left and the administrator wasn't notified. And so it's always important just to check those things if you're meeting with your administrator. And advance notice of changes in personnel is always important too. That way people can be moved off the grant and we don't have to worry about transferring costs or collecting money from somebody who's left Vanderbilt and is still getting a paycheck. We have had some situations like that also. And if you know someone is coming who is a foreign national who has a visa process, those visa processes have gotten very complicated, so it's always good to know in advance if someone's going to need a work authorization visa and you want them to work as a postdoc on your grant, to notify the administrator in advance. What departmental administrators can do for you is communicate changes in policy here at Vanderbilt, or sometimes agency policies. I work for three faculty, one of whom probably knows more about agency policy than I do, and two that are very relaxed about the information that they read. And so everybody's different. You have to kind of identify what type of faculty member you are. Some are very proactive, and others depend very heavily on their administrator for that information. So, and it's always good to know, when, you know, to be honest and upfront, you know, if you're one of those that doesn't like to read all of the wonderful guidelines that some of the federal agencies have, it might be good just to tell the administrator so that they know, that they're aware that you are depending largely on them for that information. Interpreting the EU and agency policies and guidelines, sometimes the language can be complicated and confusing. providing education on the electronic submission mechanisms, changes and updates. Those are something that every grants administrator has to be on top of. Your grants administrator can initiate the paperwork to move personnel on and off of your grants if they need to, and also provide monthly summaries of grant activity. I think that providing the monthly summary activity varies from department to department. I know when I was the administrative officer in chemistry, we provided monthly reports. But I understand that that does vary from department to department. But if that's something that you're interested in, that's also something that you probably should communicate to the administrator in your area so that they're aware that you want those things. The squeaky wheel always gets the grease. So a lot of times the level of support that faculty in my area got depended on how much time they spent in my office. And that's just the truth. There were some that like to really be in control of their own situation, and other people that I did just about everything with related to their grants with the exception of the science. So, it's just the most important thing is that if you're better off working as a team than trying to kind of do your own thing. So, working together is always the best choice. When you've got a grant administrator and a faculty member trying to get a grant out the door in order to be successful. So those are just a few things that we take care of at the departmental level. And like I said, it really is kind of the alpha and the omega. It begins and ends in the department. So the departmental administrator is an important person for you to get to know, and
I'll just add, Shelley has been talking clearly from the perspective of a department that has a lot of externally funded research. However, even the internally funded grants that Dennis's office provides, the research scholar grants, which are predominantly for faculty in the humanities, the discovery grants, have similar requirements about budgeting, about reporting, about personnel changes, about what happens if you have cost overruns and transfers of personnel and those sorts of things. So the things that Shelley's laid out here are pretty universal, regardless of who the funder is, whether it's Vanderbilt or, NIH. Those are things you need to be aware of. I'll also add that for those of you that are in departments like English, where you don't have the kind of administrative support, in the College of Arts and Science in particular, many of you may know Susan Kuiper, who is a grants officer specifically assigned to help faculty in the humanities and the social sciences in the college, and Susan will be at the session next week. So the different schools have different ways of ensuring faculty have the support they need at the departmental level. If it's not a dedicated administrator, there are people in the schools, in the department or the dean's office that can help you with some of those things. Just to provide a little additional clarification about that.
And Susan Kuiper in the past has actually worked in an office like the one that John runs.
Right.
So she knows that side of things.
She's been a director.
Yeah, yes. She has directed a sponsored research office at a school before. So, again, someone who's available. But again, what Shelley's laid out is pretty true regardless in terms of the general approach to take. So having created your brilliant idea and provided chocolate and wine to your departmental administrator to ensure that everything's ready to go, John Childress will talk about pre-award essentials.
Before we begin, I get started on my presentation. Can I see a show of hands for those folks who currently have a grant? Okay. How about those who have applied, other than those who just raised their hands, those who've applied for grants? Okay. That lets us know what kind of mix we have here. Slide.
Let me add one thing. Yeah. In your packet, at the very back, you have full-size copies of the charts. because I at least, Dennis and I could not read these reduced. So I'm just letting you know that this chart is in full size, and the other charts are in full size at the back of your handout.
Okay, this this particular slide, I mean, there are a lot of different ways to do this, and I'm going to make three or four points about this slide. Probably it should have followed the slide that comes next, but that's okay. I didn't make that change.
We can do that.
I just want to give you a little bit of an idea of how our office is structured, because it is important, as Shelley touched upon just a moment ago, with regard to what kind of funding arrangements you're looking for. On the lower left-hand side there, you'll note that there is a group called the Grants Management Group. Well, if you're applying for grants or contracts, grants, not contracts, but grants, you will have this. You'll be working with this particular group, an individual from this particular group. If you're in a contract situation, again, you're dealing with industry, you will at some point encounter one of the two assistant directors who work in the contract management group and negotiate contracts for non-medical agreements. Our staff is allocated to help you based on departments. If you're in the chemistry department, you deal, as Shelley is, you deal essentially with Pat Green. If you're in sociology, it is, well, it's also Pat Green. If you're in English, it would be Holland Carley. So, and if you're in engineering, there's a 99.9% chance you're going to be dealing with Carol Hatchett. With regard to contracts, it just depends upon the workload at the moment. The contracts are allocated based on that. We're working toward putting a better system in place. Now, if you want to find out where, who is the administrator for your department, it's on our website. It's broken down by the list of individuals and what departments they're responsible for. We have a support group over on the right-hand box, or the infrastructure support group, export compliance. And if those of you, and I think I heard a couple of folks say you're in English, if you think that doesn't apply to you, you're wrong. If you're traveling outside of the country and taking your laptop, that's covered under U.S. export control law. We have an individual who prepares and delivers training sessions on a variety of topics to departmental administrators and other groups on campus, and we have a computer programmer who assists in maintaining all of the things that we have that are electronic. Okay, the circle down on the lower right-hand side shows where we fit within the Vanderbilt Research dynasty here. And
ta-da!
Left side, sorry.
There it is.
I have trouble with that right-left. So down in the left-hand corner.
Yep.
And we are part of Dennis's office, Associate ta-da. Provost for Research and Dean of the Graduate School. And this doesn't represent all eight chancellors, but it does represent those who have a role to play within the research mission of the university. Now, you'll note that the export control box, which is right in the center of the chart, is a direct report to our office, but I put it in the center because it's a campus-wide function. That function is housed in our office, but it also serves the medical center. With regard to those issues. If you have questions with regard to what export means to you, export control means to you, we can answer that. I'll be happy to answer those later. But you can see the groups like Environmental Health and Safety, Office of Technology, Transfer and Enterprise Development, OTED, the Institutional Review Board, the Animal Care and Use Committee, and so forth. These offices, as you would expect, are all involved in research in some way, not necessarily as... Well, in some cases, their primary role and primary duty. But in the general counsel's office is occasionally involved in some of research-related activities, and definitely involved when things go awry. All right, just to give you a thumbnail of what research looks like at the university, not just in the University Central. But at the university, fiscal year 2008, the total sponsored research and programs was $519 million, and that includes the medical center. Of that, the non-medical portion of that was $103 million. That's the portion that is on this side of campus that my office deals with. There's a counterpart office on the medical center side, and you can't shop for submitting proposals. And we're ranked 20th by the National Science Foundation in federal funding for science, engineering, research, and development. And between us and the medical center office, we process around 3,000 proposals a year and probably another 1,500 or so. What would that be, Michelle? Would you say 1,500 a year awards would be? And the number, I think that is fairly accurate, about another 1,500 to 1,800 awards a year. Michelle, I know, is thinking, well, I've got a whole lot more centers and accounts out there than that that are active. But it is a significant number of proposals and awards, but right around 3,000 proposals. All right, the process for running the treadmill here and getting things done, getting your work done, obviously Shelly gave you some outstanding advice with regard to your first step, and your first step is to contact your departmental administrator and do that as early as possible when you're getting ready to submit a proposal. Proposals are initiated, of course, by the PI. We can give you limited assistance in finding sources of support. We're happy to do that and happy to work with you, but as you saw in the initial slide, we have a fairly small staff. And unless you're just drawing a blank on who you might look to for external funding, then we're probably not going to be the fastest resource that you would come to. But we do underwrite a database that is sponsored, that is housed at the library, called Research Research, which is accessible from our website. And that website will allow you to do searches to look for external support. Plus, there are a bunch of other websites out there, particularly with regard to federal funding and federal research. And frankly, it's...
How many of you have heard of this research facility? Yeah, that's what I thought.
Oh, yeah.
So there is a... Well, we buy it. You know, we pay for it every year. It's a service that you can connect with. You can create keywords and what have you so that you can get broadcast notices when agencies release funding opportunities. And it's easy to sign up for, do it all online. It's we pay for it. Please use it.
And the all proposals, routing and approvals begin at the department level. The department chair and your departmental administrator both play roles there in getting things into the appropriate approval chain. All proposals at Vanderbilt as of October 1st of this year are to be
last year.
Last year, yes. I live on fiscal years.
Sorry.
Last year, 2008, are to be approved through the electronic routing and submission system that we have called COEUS, and I can go into great detail on what that what COEUS means in a lot of ways. And after it is, but the approvals are electronic. They go from the department chair to the which is looking mainly at the. Preparation support for developing COEUS proposals that could be approved and go out the door, and the chair review and approval. I think Shelley has pretty well already touched on the kinds of things that the department can do for you, so I won't dwell on that slide. Next one.
Oh.
And the next.
Oh, okay.
All right, now a little bit about COEUS. As an interjection here before it the slide gets to the before we get to the D, there is a on our website there is a lot of information provided with regard to submitting proposals via COEUS. There are classes that departmental administrators take. There are 10 hours of training that departmental administrators take in order to learn to use the COIA system. Faculty are welcome to do that if you would like to spend 10 hours in these training sessions to put your proposals together. Some have. Some faculty have done that. But you don't get development permissions in COIAs to fully develop and use the system unless you have gone through the full 10 hours of training.
John?
Yes?
Does that training cost anything?
No. It's free. Well, other than the sweat and toil that one has to go through to do it. COIAS is a system, as I said before, that allows you to develop your proposal. It has a lot of built-in features where you don't have to worry about indirect cost rates, fringe benefit rates, and those kinds of things. It does automatic calculations for you and allows you to essentially create your entire proposal and get it approved through the university channels. One of the features that some faculty like and some don't is that faculty actually submit their proposals. They're approved, but faculty submit their proposals, which allows you to work on your project narrative up until the last minute if that's what you want to do. You can get the approval for the budget anytime that you would like in advance, 2 weeks in advance if you like, once your budget's set, because it can't be changed unless it goes all the way back through the system again. But is a feature that, as I say, some faculty like, some faculty don't. The dean's role, we move away from the department and COIAS to the dean's role. The deans are very much concerned with a lot of things, but with cost sharing, certainly. And any cost sharing that you is required by the sponsor or is required or that you would like to commit to a project, you should have a discussion with your dean ahead of time about it, and that's before you put the proposal together to get the dean's concurrence that that's acceptable. And the deans they field these calls fairly frequently, I guess, and so they know how to give the answer that's appropriate, but it is something that has to be approved by the dean ahead of time, otherwise you run the risk of angering the dean. They review the proposed budget for consistency with your appointment at the university and consistency with what their expectations would be in terms of the dollars that they would need to see coming from a grant-funded activity based on the amount of time that you're committing to the project. And they are certainly concerned with extraordinary physical arrangements that might be necessary because of the work that you're proposing. In other words, if in mechanical engineering you need a new lab constructed and that doesn't show up in the budget, then somebody's going to have to explain that to the dean as to why that is. And they certainly do check for those things. And for the obvious reasons, that's important.
Well, I will just interject one thing, and not. I guess it's stating the obvious. When we talk about the dean has to approve it, we don't literally mean Carolyn Dever has to look at your budget and review it, or Ken Galloway has to. There is an associate dean for finance in each of your school offices, and that's the person you want to really talk to first. And again, often your departmental administrator will sort of lay the groundwork for you in having those conversations. So it's just you can't go forward with this stuff. And Dennis will talk again a little bit about the way finances at Vanderbilt are handled. You can't go forward with some of these things without making sure that your school is behind it and is in support of it and agrees to it. So dean is shorthand for that office, wherever it may be.
And if you are talking about significant financial commitments in terms of cost sharing and so forth, 9 times out of 10, the dean is going to be approved.
But you start usually with the associate dean for finance in your own school. So.
Okay, so after the dean is satisfied that the budget meets all of his or her requirements, they approve it and it comes to us electronically through COIAS and in the Division of Sponsored Research. And we're responsible for, we're the university's signatory. We sign off on all non-medical proposals. that go out of Vanderbilt seeking extramural support. We review for compliance issues, both with university policies, conflict of interest, committee approvals, and so forth, committee approvals like the Institutional Review Board, and so forth. And with regard to general sponsor policies, we ask that we have the COIS approval package, which does not necessarily have to include your narrative. As I said, you can get the budget approved once it's set in concrete and you're ready to go with it 2 weeks ahead of time if you'd like. But we need to have the that package, the approval package, in our office at least 3 days before the sponsor deadline, because we do, like I said, have to review your proposal and how it applies to, or how university policy and sponsor policy would apply to your proposal. And as I said before, the PI, once we've approved the proposal, your budget's locked.
And I'm sorry to interrupt, but again, something that I didn't appreciate until I came to work on this side of campus, the majority of grants are actually made to Vanderbilt. With the exception of fellowships, these grants are not made to you as individual faculty. So you're committing Vanderbilt to something when you submit that grant. And that's one of the things that I know can be a little frustrating for faculty. Well, why do you have to have these people look at all these policies? Because Vanderbilt is responsible if there is a problem with a grant, again, unless it's a fellowship. So that's understanding why that's there. We hope you'll be a little more forgiving sometimes when we ask for a little more time to look at some of these things.
Can I interject something?
Sure.
Quickly? Yeah. Also, just some sponsors don't require you to submit a budget, but Vanderbilt still, and correct me if I'm wrong, John, Vanderbilt still wants to see you put together a detailed budget, even if the sponsor just, you know, there's lotteries. Sometimes they just give away X amount of dollars, almost like a lottery, and you just put your name in a hat. Vanderbilt still wants to see, you know, wants some idea of how you're going to spend that money, even if the sponsor that you're applying to doesn't care, right? Isn't that the case? And so sometimes the agency requirements or the sponsor's requirements and Vanderbilt's requirements aren't exactly, you know, just because the sponsor might not want a detailed budget from you, maybe they just want an idea on paper and a paragraph, Vanderbilt still wants to see some things routed through so they have an idea of what you're going to be doing if the award is made.
And the other thing I will add is that proposals to some non-federal funders are not actually submitted via COIS, but you still go through COIS for the routings, for the sign-off, for the electronic okay, just because, again, it's electronic, it speeds it through. You know, some of the private foundations have their own website you submit through, the ACLS you submit through them, NEH you actually submit through the NEH website, not through COIS. So, but COIS is still the place where you put all this stuff and it gets approved and gets routed. Ready?
All right. Now we talked. What we've been talking about so far is pre-award stuff, getting the proposal in, getting it out, and so forth. And this is going to be a fairly quick summary, simply because in many ways it is a mirror image of the process for submitting proposals. As far as post-award management by Division of Sponsored Research, we don't do any financial management. We have a wonderful office that Michelle's going to tell you all about in just a second that does all that stuff, and I'm thankful that they do it because they're very good at it, and I wouldn't be. But we're involved in all non-financial compliance issues. If you need a no-cost extension for your award, or you have a contract issue that comes up, or reporting issue that comes up, a concern about what your obligations are, so forth, then we're the group that you want to talk with. We can help decipher some of the legalese and bureaucracies that goes along with your award. We do have a function in the award budgeting process. Now, the award budget, once you get that award, it follows the same review and approval process, though right now not through COEAS. It's still a paper process, though that may change here in the next few months. Our role in that is that we're making certain that the funds that you've budgeted in the that you want budgeted in the accounting system represent what the sponsor will allow you to budget for. So we're checking to make sure that the sponsor's intentions are being carried out. That doesn't mean that in some instances you can't modify your budget. Sure you can, but we're making certain that the sponsor's rules are being adhered to when those budgets are being set up. We develop subcontracts in our office and assist in monitoring those subcontracts along with contracting grant accounting. Again, the financial versus the non-financial aspects of that monitoring. We negotiate agreements with external parties. Engineering, of course, has a lot of corporate support or pass-through or flow-through money from the government through corporations, and we would negotiate those contracts. And as I said before, we are involved in export compliance. All right. Now, the most important thing that I will say is, go to the website. We do have a lot of information on there. We're doing some renovation work on it right now, but there's information there on COEAS, departmental assignments, proposal preparation information that you would need to prepare a proposal here at Vanderbilt, all those mysterious numbers that particularly federal sponsors want to see on there that you just kind of say, well, why would you want that? And I say that very often myself. We also host the internal grant competition information that Elizabeth was telling you about earlier on from our website. So you can get information on that there. And if you need to contact us, the main phone number is 322-2631. And the email address here will, if you don't know who to talk with, you just have a question or whatever, everybody in the office, all of the contract administrators and grant administrators in the office will get this. And then the one that deals with your area, your department, will be the person who will respond back. So it's pretty straightforward. You can always call, and we'll get you to the right person.
So you got your great big honking grant, and now you want to spend it. And Michelle will talk a bit about how you can do that, or if you can do that.
That's right. I'm Michelle Reichman. I am over at the Postal Work Office. So once you do receive those grants, I know you're all going to receive at some point. Our office is the one you'll deal with if you have questions about management, and especially when it comes to financial issues and a lot of the compliance issues on can I do this and things like that. One of the points I will make that may not have been apparent to go on top of something Elizabeth said and then John's conversation, but John is the institutional rep for the university, for all university schools. So John's the one that actually has to be the final signature and submit an award. You can't do it on your own. It needs to go through John. And I'm listed as the financial rep. So if there are financial reports or things that deal with dollars and or compliance, they're going to be looking for my authorization or signature. So a lot of stuff does have to. That's why it'll up to those central offices. And again, Vanderbilt is receiving those grants. So we have to ensure that one, because Vanderbilt is going online and assuring we have the infrastructure to support that kind of activity here with all the things that are included in the proposals. And they understand that we do have that, and we go through audits periodically that reinforces that. And so that's really important that you guys understand that and why we have to sometimes be in the mix. Something I will say to emphasize back to Shelley is I hope you have a Shelley because it's very important. I actually, of all of us, the Shelleys of the world may be your best friend in this process. But I am also aware some of you don't have Shelleys, or you have Shelleys that don't deal with grants that often. Our offices do step in those situations and will help you. We do it all the time. And we provide ad hoc training if necessary to assist you or to help assist that administrator maybe get a little bit more up to speed on a particular agency you may be trying to deal with. Unfortunately, all federal agencies and non-federal, but especially the federal, are not created equal. So there are some that are more painful than others. I'm not going to scare you at this point. I'm just going to tell you that's something to be aware of. And so, and we'll be aware of those kind of things, and we can help you with some of the problems that may arise with a particular agency that may be a little bit more difficult to deal with than others. So
I'll interject one other thing to this point. Just as Shelley is an example of someone who's been in several different departments. I just found out Susan, who used to work for you,
yes,
is now the departmental administrator for English.
That's right.
So she was in Dennis's office, then she worked in chemical and biomolecular engineering and corporate and foundation fundraising. She's now the departmental administrator for English. So don't presume just because you're in the humanities that your departmental administrator is not necessarily that savvy.
And Susan's very savvy.
And Susan's very savvy. So the point is, to reinforce Michelle's point, that...
And we're seeing more. I mean, the good news, political science, who used to be a non-player, is now a huge player in the grant world with Seligson when he came on board. So we're seeing departments that historically did not have a lot of grant activity
right.
have a lot of grant activity.
And the resources will flow to support that.
Jay Clayton, the chair of the English department, has had a grant from NIH.
Exactly. Yeah. And so it's possible you may deal with any of these agencies
yep.
at some point in time. But if you do not have an administrator, I think that I would make sure, please don't hesitate to call my office if you have grants questions or management questions, because that's what we're there for. Later on, I show you our website. I would recommend that you go there and get familiar with that. We have a lot of information on that website. I didn't do a flow chart like John did, but there is clear instructions on who you might need to call. The accountants that work for me are divided up by agency. So if you've got an NIH, there is a contact and they deal with it regardless of what it is. It's NIH, Department of Ed, NSF. So that's all clearly defined who you might call. We also have a main number and you can call that and you will get to the right person. We will make sure. So you get the award. So we're going to be we're kind of the end of the trail, just like in this presentation. We're at the end, and so the buck stops with us. So we get all this lovely information, and we need to set it up for you. So we will be the ones that get you that magic 10-digit number that is your key to spending what you have been awarded. So we get it set up in the general ledger, and that opens a lot of doors for you. It will allow you to get people paid. It will allow you to do purchase orders. It's going to allow you to buy supplies and things like that. So we're very popular when you get an award because you want to get that magic 10-digit number. So our accountants will get that set up and notify you that that's there. There is a day lag. So if we set it up today, it's really not available to the next day for all the systems that we have now because we're getting so many electronic systems on campus, which is a good thing, that it would be recognized. So that next day, though, you're in business and you're good to go. We're the ones that'll get you the money. Don't assume just because you got the grant, we're going to get the money. So if our folks don't do the job, we're not going to get that money in hand. So my accountants are the ones, if you're NIH, for example, we're doing a letter of credit draw. We draw down those funds. We don't submit individual invoices to them. And we do that for the institution. So we also draw all the federal funds for the medical center as well out of my office. But for agencies like the Department of Defense, we are actually submitting invoices. And on the university side, currently we're submitting probably about 300 invoices a month for agencies that we have to invoice. And then we have some that may be quarterly or semi-annual, things like that. For the bulk of it, though, we are actually drawing now over $30 million a month from the federal government to cover our grant expenditures. And so that's important. I highly recommend if you haven't already, if you've already got grants or you're looking to get grants, that you do go to our websites and familiarize yourself with our policies. We have a lot of policies at this institution, and those are really Vanderbilt's interpretations of OMB circulars that override grant management. So costing policies that come out of OMB circular, you may have heard of this or you will hear of it as you do more grant work. A21 and A110 really guide, they're the foundation on how institutions are supposed to handle these funds and manage them. But make sure you're familiar with our policies, because these are going to be critical to how you manage, how you spend money. You need to make sure you understand effort reporting and cost transfers and all these things that are become common terms for you as you become more entrenched in the grant world. My office is also, we have, if expenditure is over $3,000 on a sponsored program, it will come to our office for pre-screening. And that is, we're just trying to make sure, it used to be $500 a long time ago, if you can imagine. I've been here 24 years, so I've been doing this a long time. But we used to see everything that was $500 or more. As you can imagine, that got very laborious over time. And so it's now $3,000, but that doesn't include salary transactions. Those are not pre-screened, if you will, through our office. But it does include if you're buying equipment and things like that. So we would pre-screen just to make sure that this is not something that potentially needed a prior approval from an agency or something like that. And then we do the financial reporting from our office. So when Shelley alluded to the reports and closeouts, the departments are going to be responsible, the PI is going to be responsible for the progress report, technical type reports, things like that. Our office will be the one for the institution that needs to ensure those financial reports get submitted. Now, we will do that in conjunction with you. If you haven't already figured out from the way we're talking, we become one big team, and your success in this whole and your happiness with the process is the better team we are, the better this all works. So I think communication amongst all the players is key. And we will be prompting from our office as milestones occur that we may need something for you to be able to do a financial report. There may be some additional information that is not housed within the general ledger that we may be coming to you for. And then also managed outside of, in our office, is the fixed assets monitoring inventory. I threw that in there just that it is something you may touch at some point. If you do have equipment that you're responsible for, you've bought on your grants, you're going to become familiar with. Periodically, people come out and want to make sure the tags are there and that you fill out your inventory correctly, because we do have to monitor that and keep up and make sure fixed assets is reconciled to the general ledger. So that's something you may have to deal with as well. We very much have a key role in compliance of the financial nature, and some of the things that fall under financial compliance you may not think in relation to, but the first thing is high-risk transactions, foreign travel, equipment, things like that that from a sponsor's perspective could potentially be high-risk. Those are things that we do ad hoc kind of monitoring from our office and look at things periodically, pull things. Administrative and clerical support on grants, that's only okay in certain circumstances. So we do analysis if we see that in areas, and we come out and do some have conversations with departments if we're seeing dollars we're not sure, you know, may be appropriate for the type of grant you have. Cost transfers. There is a cost transfer policy. Again, if you go to our website and look at policies, cost transfers are when you're moving a cost that you initially charged to one grant, and now you're coming back at a later point in time and say, I really need to put it on this grant. Government doesn't want that. They really want us to get it right the first time. So these things are red flags. In an audit, they're always red flags. And so there's policy and framework of which when we have something like that, and trust me, you will have something. You will have a cost transfer in your life if you do grants. But we try to make sure with our policy and our processes that we do the best job up front of justifying that and documenting it so that the government does not have a problem with it if they come in and review it. There are legitimate reasons why it could happen. What they don't want to see is that it is a course of business to do a lot of transferring amongst grants as opposed to really managing them on the front end. Because they don't want you to think it's one big pot of money. Even though you may think that, just don't acknowledge that. I mean, you may have several grants that are really supporting your body of work, but you need to keep those in distinct buckets as far as management and financial oversight to keep things clean. The one area that we're over that doesn't necessarily, people don't think about financial compliance, but it has to do with effort reporting. It's salaries and wages is the largest single component on a grant. Generally speaking, they run for unless it's an equipment grant, 60 to 70% of dollars a week house in salaries and wages. So from the government's perspective, this is very critical that they have some assurance that we're overseeing and monitoring this. And Vanderbilt has something called plan confirmation. That is the method that we use to certify efforts. So anyone that receives a salary from a federal project, any portion of their salary that comes from a federal project, is required to certify that through our effort reporting process. And so it's real important that this is something you understand. And there is a policy, again, on our website. I can tell you, we just went through a very extensive audit over the last 2 years that we just completed in the fall with NSF, National Science Foundation, that was on effort reporting. And all in all, it was very painful for many of us in the room to go through. Dennis was a part of that, and I actually had a front row seat. So, but we survived. We came out probably stronger, and we have a better idea of some things. I will tell you, we have made some changes as a result of that, some guidance that we're giving. We will be opening this policy this year to tweak it and refine it to get it in line with some of the guidance that came from the National Science Foundation. And if you haven't heard, there is an electronic system on campus called EPAC, of which is how payroll is processed now on the campus. And not only does it process payroll, it also is the vehicle for which you certify your effort. So it's online, and it follows our policy and notifies you when there is something out there for you to certify. But effort reporting is really important. One of the things that came out of NSF, and they did interviews with faculty and graduate students and stuff, is they didn't feel like our faculty and students were as up on what our policies were as they should be. That being said, it wasn't like we had a lot of problems, but they wanted them to be able to articulate better what our policies and procedures were. So we've really made some strides and tried to go out and talk to faculty and get in with dean's offices and come to regular meetings they have to kind of make sure people understand what our policies are and understand that. So this is something you'll definitely want to be a part of. And then we also coordinate any audits. So any audits that come into campus, our office is going to be a liaison. If you get notified of an audit, do not talk to anybody unless you let us know immediately. We will do that coordination. They are not supposed to be talking to faculty or graduate students directly, so we coordinate that and we'll be a partner with you in the event you are audited. So you would definitely look to OCGA for that. We also oversee in our office the F&A rates, which is, you may know as F&A rates or indirect cost or overhead, but that's if you get a grant, a piece of your dollars are going to go to fund the indirect cost. It's not a tax, it's true cost that the institution has incurred to be able to do the kind of research that Vanderbilt does. So, and it's only a partial reimbursement. There's an elaborate process that we go through to come up with those rates, so it truly is only a partial reimbursement of real cost. And we also negotiate and prepare the fringe benefit rates. So our fringe benefits are charged out on a rate basis, not actual cost. And we also oversee, you may at some point have dealings with service centers. Those are operations on campus that may charge out for services. If you're in chemistry, there's a chemistry storeroom. There's a physics machine shop. They have developed rates so that they're approved, so that the rates are fair, especially when charged to grants. The government understands we're overseeing that, not overcharging them. That's our website. Again, it's pretty easy to navigate. You can go through and you can quickly get to the policy section. I highly recommend you look at those and familiarize yourself with those. There is, periodically, we do training, set training, but we also, if there is a need, do ad hoc training. If you call us, we will try to work with you and get something if there's a particular something you're concerned about, and we'll get work with you to get that training. And that's my contact information, and don't hesitate to call. That's what we're there for.
So you guys have been very quiet. And so we're bringing out the big gun for the wrap-up. Dennis?
Hi. My office operates at the policy level. At some universities, you will find research and graduate education kind of integrated, which is how things are here. And at other universities, you will have completely separate organizations. And I think if you were to watch any university over time, you'd probably find them coming together, moving apart, coming together. So there's kind of the mood of the moment. So the mood of the moment is that they're integrated. I also serve, I'm the one publicly known member of the university's Promotion and Tenure Review Committee. That's a committee of 9 people. 8 of them serve 3-year rotating terms. But there's one continuing member for continuity who represents the university at large, and that's me. So I've been on the Promotion and Tenure Review Committee for 8.5 years, and at least in University Central, that means I have read every tenure and promotion case in the university since the summer of 2000, which is when I arrived here. So somehow, graduate education and research do sort of come to roost within the tenure and promotion process. So there is a sort of logical grouping there. I joined the university in the summer of 2000 and came here to be the Associate Provost for Research. The university hadn't had one before. That was one of the appeals of the job, is there was no template to fit into. And when I was being recruited, I would talk to, say, 50 different faculty members, and they'd have 50 different descriptions of what that job would be. So it was clear to me it would be whatever I did, because it really wasn't a very tight script. And I sort of inherited the graduate school a bit later on. I want you to know that I think about the world largely as a faculty member and department chair. I spent 20 years before coming here at the University of Rochester in New York, and I was a department chair the last 7 years I was there. So that's actually been a very good experience, because now I've been here 8.5 years. I've come to know 2 major research universities very well, and I think that provides a perspective that is really useful on a lot of fronts. You really get to see that on some level, universities are very similar, but at other little discrete junctures, they're really quite different. It's good to have that appreciation, and it gives you a sense that there really is no magic way to do anything. Basically, there are many ways to get to a successful and welcome endpoint, so you don't really have to dig in on any one thing. You can find workarounds and different ways of going about things. It's a very healthy attitude to have, I think. So I was trying to think back to when I was a relatively new assistant professor, and what I would have thought of hearing this very mechanics-oriented kind of a description of research. And these are all important and essential, but I would say that I started my faculty life being pretty naive on an almost uncountable number of levels. And so probably, I'm guessing if you were anything remotely like me, there was probably a lot of terminology that you didn't quite understand. And Michelle mentions EPAC. I know exactly what EPAC is. Do any of you know what EPAC is? Yeah. So, and I think this is, it's really important to recognize that you actually have a lot to learn, that there is an actual profession, there is an actual business, there is actual material, just like there is a strong core of material in a subject like English or mechanical engineering. The conduct of research at a university really requires professionals because it's complicated. The execution of it is governed in so many ways by federal law, federal regulations. You know how the government is. If you take $1 of federal money, you get all of their regulations. Whether you know it or not, when someone at the university submits a proposal to a federal agency and we accept an award, John's office basically signs off on two dozen or more regulations. You know, your proposal goes to NEH. We affirm that we are a drug-free workplace and a whole bunch of other stuff that you would imagine has absolutely nothing to do with anything you're doing. But this is why the award goes to the university, because we are obligated on all of these accounts, conflict of interest regulations, the way we involve human subjects in research, the way animals are involved in research. It just goes on and on and on and on. And we affirm that every single time that we send a proposal to the government and accept their money. And all of this machinery represented by these offices and more is really dictated by that. We have to do it or you can't have an award. And that's how it is. So I hope you will move forward recognizing that you actually have a lot to learn about this, and you will. It just kind of, especially if you are in a federal grant-connected arena, you go through the process a couple of times and you get the rhythm. And then for the rest of your career, you kind of decorate that with little ornaments of information that you pick up along the way. And if you're not careful, you will assimilate it reasonably well, and then you'll have a job like mine. So I say this with some warning. Let's see. So I wanted to, I knew we would get to this moment, and I wanted to be sure to communicate to you something about the success of the university and a sense of enthusiasm about the university's trajectory. So for a number of years, I've basically been making this slide. As I said, I came here in 2000, so my Vanderbilt existence begins then. So 2001 was the conclusion of my first year, and I just kind of measure everything from that point to see how we're doing. And since my world revolves around graduate education and research, that's sort of an amalgam of numbers at a high altitude here. And what you can see is the institution's progress has really been extraordinary on just about every measure. When I arrived here in the summer of 2000, people would describe the university as having a history of being a first-rate undergraduate institution and a first-rate institution for professional schools, top 20 law school, top 20 medical school, and so on. But that the university had not committed itself in the same way to research and to graduate education in those fields associated with the College of Arts and Science, the School of Engineering, sort of academic core of the place. But I think, in fact, the institution decided in 1999 that it really wanted to change that, and it wanted to bring graduate education and research up to the level the steadily advancing level of the professional schools and the undergraduate enterprise. And so the progress, I think, is extraordinary. I never imagined, in fact, if you looked at this slide two or three years ago, it still looked impressive. In fact, I happen to remember that if you look at University Central, not the medical center, and looked at the external research dollar numbers, they doubled between 2001 and 2005. And if you double in that period of time, it's a 14% per year increase. So it's kind of an extraordinary progress, and it keeps on going, even though there are budget challenges in Washington that largely are beyond our control. If the NIH budget goes flat, there's really not a lot we can do about that by sending a proposal somewhere. It's really a level or two beyond us. So anyway, just to look at it, you can see that the number of graduate school applications has doubled. We haven't really changed the size of the pool of offers we make. We still make just under 1,000 offers. But now we're only making offers to something like 16% of those who apply, whereas that number was 36% in 2001. We're seeing better yield on our offers. The graduate student population on the campus has increased. We've gone from 168 PhDs a year to 250 PhDs a year. If you look in one of John Childers' slides, you'll find a slightly different number here. It was 519 million. This is because we actually have two different ways of doing this calculation. A later version of this slide that I use now just says greater than $500 million, but it's not really worth talking about the difference, so I'm not. We have two different ways of counting. So anyway, the university is on a very positive trajectory. We're very disappointed for all kinds of reasons that the economic sky has fallen in the United States. And on this point, Michelle mentioned that we recently went through an NSF audit of effort. This is labor charges to NSF grants in a certain period of time. And I'll tell you that when all was said and done, we had to pay NSF back $31,000. Okay, $31,000. So, you know, $31,000. This is nothing. Now, I wish I understood why it is that the federal government will invest so much time and effort in controlling the way college professors spend their time. But the Securities and Exchange Commission
Dennis.
could not keep an eye on Bernie Madoff, who made off with $50 billion. And they go through all of us and they find $31,000.
Let me interject that you may have seen the headlines recently, the education media headlines recently, where Yale just wrote a check for $7.6 million under similar audit circumstances.
Yeah. And Yale had problems. Yale had problems. But their problems added up to $7.6 million. I wish we had... Okay. This really aggravates me. Next one.
Does the university plan to make as many offers funded this year, this coming year?
What does that mean?
Last year?
Offers funded.
To graduate students, to people who apply for graduate school.
So yeah, we're not cutting the number of graduate ones.
Not at all.
That's right.
Okay.
Have you heard otherwise? We're not.
Okay. No.
Another list I wanted to pass along to you is this one, and actually the next slide is just this one year earlier. But a few years ago, as just another way of keeping track of our progress, I started putting on one page a list of the universities that ranked in the top 25 on both of two lists. One list is the U.S. News and World Report ranking, and the other list is one of NSF's approaches, and John actually mentioned this before. So every year they will publish something called Federal Obligations for Science and Engineering R&D. It basically means grant awards for science and engineering R&D. Now, science and engineering doesn't catch everything, but it's so don't think of this as the totality. Just think of it as an indicator along the way. It doesn't catch a bunch of education funding, for example. We have a lot of education funding.
Actually, it does now. They are including that. We do have the humanities down at the bottom. It historically did not, but it does. They are starting to get in there.
Even better.
Right.
Even better.
This particular table, though, is it excludes it for this particular table.
Yeah, there are 25 or 50 of these things that NSF posts. You can go to page and just sift through. But this is the one historically we have tracked. So my point is that there are only 12 universities in the country that rank in the top 25 on both of these lists. So you should recognize you're working at a very accomplished university. And in some sense, these are the universities that are kind of our aspirational peers because they have strong undergraduate missions and they have strong research missions. And they're different. Some places will have big medical schools like we do. MIT has a different profile. But the point is they have a commitment to research in some way, and this list shows which ones are very prominent in combination with a strong undergraduate program. So I think this is an important list. If you flip to the next one, you'll see we moved from number 23 last year to number 20 on the right, and from number 19 last year to number 18 on the left. So there's even progress visible, you can see, in these years. The U.S. News and World Report ranking sort of diddles around a little bit. So if you looked at it 10 years in a row, you might see that bouncing around. But anyway, this represents the last 2 years. See, what's next? Aha. So on John Childress's website for the Division of Sponsored Research, I actually have a frequently asked questions sheet, a few sheets with answers, and I listed a few of those here. So the first one speaks to how one gains access to the funding provided by my office. So, and for comparison, this did not happen at the University of Rochester. There was no internal program that faculty applied to. But here there are a couple of them. And there's an announcement made every September. All members of the tenured and tenure track faculty get an announcement in September that says, that basically issues a call for proposals for the Discovery Grant Program and the Research Scholar Grant Program. So every year I have about $1 million a year to award in the one category and $500,000 in the other. So I collect proposals. In the case of the humanities program, the Research Scholar Grant program, there's an internal review group of senior faculty who decide sort of a rank ordering of the proposals. And I make awards until I run out of money. On the science and engineering side, we add a step. We do external reviews. So I send out, we're in the middle of that right now, I send out proposals to people in the university community throughout the United States, and I require that I have at least 2 external reviews for a proposal in order for it to move forward in the competition to the internal review committee. And this, I started doing this just because it gave us an affirmation about the quality of the work, but I found a side benefit, and I now think about it differently. So it turns out that certainly that's valuable. But equally valuable, I think, is the advertising. Because I started getting communications from reviewers say, what a great forward-looking program this is. I wish my university had this. So I think over time, I think 100, 120 reviews each year. We're now working on year 9. So pretty soon, you start really having this message seep out into the university community, and it kind of changes perceptions of the university. So I now think of the external review process as being half about getting the specific input on the quality and content of the proposal, and the other half spreading the word that we have serious things going on here. And when this is combined with the fact that the external reviewers really find the proposals to be impressive, it really sends a good message for us. So, anyway, know that these programs are available. Watch for the announcement every September. An awful lot of people have gotten these. And I think we have direct evidence that substantial amounts of external funding have been built on what is seeded by these internal by this internal competition.
We'll talk more detail next week on some of the mechanics of these and what they're like and that sort of thing.
Another thing I wanted to mention, is a question I am frequently asked is about book subventions, and those of you in the humanities will care about this. Those in book-based disciplines will find themselves at some point wanting to publish a book, and as the financial situation continues to develop as it has, publishers will often ask for a financial contribution from the home institution. And so we do that. And so there are a couple of ways to go about it. One is you can simply apply for that from our Research Scholar Grant program, so you can respond to the call for proposals in September. Often that doesn't work out because things happen on a shorter time frame. You know, you find out in February you need $5,000. What do you do? So we have a way of dealing with that too. And for those of you in the College of Arts and Science, and that's where most of this is, one basically starts with the dean's office. So if the dean's office can affirm that this is a project that ought to be funded, then my office splits the cost 50-50 with the dean's office in A&S. So you can be sure that when the time comes, talk to your dean's office or call my office, either one, and we sort this out. But be assured we're aware of it. It's important, and we do find ways to pay for it.
Does that have legal implications for the contract you sign with the publisher? As far as royalties and copyright and things like that?
Legal implications.
Right. I mean, you own the copyright, you get the royalties, right?
But if somebody university? Else, no, we wouldn't do that.
No. Okay. No, you own the copyright.
Yeah, we don't take that.
If you're asked to sign it over, generally that's the case, that you sign it over to the publisher. But that belongs to you for those kinds of things.
Right. And then finally, I happen to have this. So this is the record. Remember I showed you on that index that the university was number 20. This actually shows you the progress starting in 2001. And this is a two-year lagging indicator. So the number that's announced in 2001 is based on the numbers 2 years earlier and so on. So since I had it, I thought I would just throw it up and you could have it and say, wow, I could be part of that. So there are two or three other things. Can I take another couple of minutes?
We're at 5:30, but and we said we'd try and in now, but if you all are game, and he's dependent on me for a ride back to his office.
There is that.
Yeah,
it's
cold out.
So
if you're amenable, if anyone needs to leave, though, please feel free.
I wanted to touch upon a feature of the university budget. This comes up all the time, and this is a macro notion. Just to help you have a framework for how the place works. This is about who does what. As you wander about the university trying to figure out who can help me do this or that or the other thing, at some point you're going to come to a question of, like, why can't you help me with this? And I will say, no, you have to go there. And the reason is, basically, there's only one university budget. And so all we're talking about is distribution mechanisms and controlling the workload. A good example would be conference support. In fact, if you go on John's website, you will actually find that there is a letter I wrote. It shows it's from the provost, but it's really from me. because we needed a policy on this. Faculty want to have conferences. Fine. So the question is, who helps pay for that? Typically, we want the outside world to pay for it. but that doesn't always work. And so who does it? So we didn't have a policy on this at some point. So a few years ago, I pulled the deans and the provost in a room with me to talk this through. Who is going to pay for this? So it's a question, do we want to fund it centrally, essentially out of the provost budget, or do we want to fund it at the dean's level? So if we were to fund it centrally, yeah, as I said, there's only one budget, and this is really important. In order to pay for it centrally, what that means is, at Vanderbilt, the deans are actually the revenue collectors. So we would have to tax the deans by a certain amount in order to create a central pool, and then say I would oversee that to deal with these conference requests. An alternative would be to simply let the deans continue to have the money and make those decisions at the dean's level. And the dean's level is actually a little closer to the action anyway, and it's generally a good policy to make your decisions close to where the activity is actually happening. And so the deans actually decided they would prefer to handle it individually. And you can imagine cases where two deans might be interested in a certain conference. And so that's okay. The two would just figure out how to do it together. So the reason, so if you come to me and say, can you help me with a conference? I will say, no, you have to go to your dean for that. That's not me being whiny. It results from a process of having decided who handles what. It could have gone the other way, and then I would fund it, but the decision was actually made. So as you make your way through the university, finding out who covers what and having somebody send you elsewhere, really our policy on this is the ensemble of all such conversations that have happened over decades about who handles what. But there's really one pool of money. We're only talking about the distribution channel. So there are many examples of this. Graduate student support. There are some universities where the graduate school actually handles all graduate student support, including TA support. So if you want a certain number of teaching assistants in English, you have to go to the graduate school to get that money because that's where it's all put. That's not how it's done here. It could have been, but it's not. There are all kinds of examples of this, and at some point, in the best of all cases, a conscious decision has been made about who does what. We're still working on things that are sort of messy, but you know, every year there are fewer of them, and we're getting there. Another thing, and actually Michelle hit this point about indirect costs. Some of you already have personal experiences with indirect costs. Indirect costs are, they represent a distribution mechanism at the federal government end. The indirect costs are not actually yours. That when you get a grant, the government has simply decided that following a certain negotiated percentage, they will send the pool costs of the university to you that way. It's simply a distribution mechanism. And as Michelle pointed out, this is an under-reimbursement for actual expenses. So every couple of years, we have to negotiate a rate with the government. And in order to get that rate, they go back and they study what we've done for the last few years in order to see how much we're spending, and that determines the rate. So if we take their money and then use it for other things, that will come out in the wash in the next contract negotiation, and our indirect cost rate will go down. So we essentially have to continue to spend that money on the infrastructure costs that the government wants, or our rate will go down. So it really isn't money that is free to the university and can be rolled back to the investigator. It just doesn't work that way at all. And in fact, we should be getting somewhere between 60 and 62% as our number in order to match actual expenses. And what we're getting this year is 53.5%. So it's important as a notion for you to carry away that sponsored research is actually a subsidized activity. The institution essentially partners with the government in order to fund research. That this is not the way it's usually talked about, but anybody who's at all familiar with the spreadsheets knows that that's actually how it works. And in fact, about 10 years ago, during the latter years of the Clinton administration, there was the belief that the federal government was giving universities too much money in the form of indirect loans. And so they commissioned the RAND Corporation to carry out a big national study of this, because the expectation was the government would have to give universities less money. Turned out it went the other way. It turns out that it was easy to document that universities were adding more than $1 billion a year to compensate for under-reimbursement from the government. And so that report lives out on the web page. Everybody knows about it, but the government doesn't talk about it. So the issue kind of died. And finally, I just want to mention that we all share a common burden of compliance. All of these regulations that just increase year after year after year, you will feel it at the faculty level. We feel it at the administrative level. And it's a really sinister force, because the government keeps increasing the regulations and reporting requirements and all that bit of stuff, but they cap the portion of the indirect cost rate at 26 percentage points that covers administration. So exactly where you would need to hire people to work on this stuff, they have capped the indirect cost rate. So it really bites us in two ways. We have all this stuff to do, and then we're not actually given the resources fully to pay for the doing of it. So it's a challenge. So these people all work on various aspects of that, and you really need to kind of celebrate them doing it, because, boy, there are things that are more fun. Well, thanks for sitting through all this, and I hope you'll share some of these messages with your colleagues back in the departments. And as time passes, I'll get to know each of you a little better as you encounter these things up close and personal. Thank you.
Thank you all for coming very much. And again, if you can join us next week, this group will not be forced to return. I owe them a great debt of thanks. We have Tracy Miller from the History of Art Department, Claire McCabe from Chemical and Biomolecular Engineering, and then Susan Kuiper, who's the grants officer for the college. And I will be talking about, and even less formal than this, sort of resources, search mechanisms, tips and tricks, hints, suggestions, that sort of thing, about specific funders and dealing with these people. So thank you again very much.